All right, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, and I'm having a little bit of technical difficulty here with my tunes, but I will have that worked out here in just a moment. So I'll chat with you for a minute and tell you what's going on tonight. We've got Dr. John Shelyak with us live in the studio tonight. We'll talk with John for the great majority of the program, probably beginning in about 10 minutes or so here. Some good music for you if I can ever get it figured out how to... And, okay, now we're going to try this again. Let's do it like this. You're listening to KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. This is Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. How about it, everybody? That is the Bean Growers, and you're listening to it here on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Good morning to you, good day to you, good afternoon, whoever you may be, wherever you might be as you listen to this radio program. You're listening to it here, and I appreciate it. Thank you for supporting KOPN and community radio here in mid-Missouri, all right? Worldwide on the Internet, of course, kopn.org. I'll be with you for the next 3 hours or so, and I got a great show lined up for you this evening, including Dr. John Sheliak, live with us in the studio. So stick around, hang on. Before that, all the good stuff. Let me do my duties here and say a quick thank you to Corey. Every week, 1 hour before this program, Corey does wonderful radio theater. And you can hear it every week on Monday at 10 o'clock. Okay, that's New Wave Radio Theater with Corey. Once again, a great program this week, and she does it every week, okay? Before that, Kelvin and Eric, they do it up. Jazz plus blues equals quantum entanglement. Tech radio, keeping us up on the wild world of high technology. And Jeff Wheeler, of course, starts things off every Monday from 3 to 5 p.m. with Uncommon Light. Good music, good talk, good news. A radio revolution here on a near full moon Monday night. Moon will be full, I guess, probably Wednesday. Looking really nice out there right now. Finally got a clear evening without rain here in mid-Missouri, and we're enjoying it, okay? You're listening to it, by the way, on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, your imagination station. Thanks to everybody who joined in last week. An amazing program with Samir Osmanagic, the Bosnian pyramid story. What a remarkable thing that's happening there outside the town of Visoca in Bosnia. There really is a major pyramid complex that has been discovered and is being unearthed. And if you want to hear, you know, some of the details, listen to that program with Samir Osmanagic, who was essentially the discoverer and the primary archaeologist who's working there on the site. But just amazing story, and very, very cool, because it's only three years old or so. And you know, the controls that exist in places like Giza or the Pyramid of the Sun, or places in Mexico or Peru or Brazil or even in China or Vietnam, places like that, those places are all pretty much locked down, and you can't get in without special permits and all kinds of difficulty. But in Bosnia, because it's pretty much an open source project right now, man, anybody who gets there can go check this stuff out for themselves. And I mean, the images that I've seen are remarkable, and certainly the man who we spoke with on the air last week is no fraud, and this is a real thing that's happening there. And there's a huge bunch of archaeologists that are all going to meet in August and they're meeting there in Bosnia to discuss and move the whole thing forward. But I think it's a really exciting thing that's happening there in Bosnia. So anyway, thanks to Samir for doing the show last week. It was very, very cool and interesting, and I had no idea. So also great music from D Numbers. Wonderful stuff from Austin, Texas. Glad to share it with y'all. And by the way, the musicians that are featured on the program can be found on my website as well. Just click on over to MikeHagan.com and click on the music archives, all right? Okay, if you missed the program last week or any other for that matter, they are on the web as well in the archives. Just click on the program archives and snoop around in there and see if you find something you like. Tonight we will have Dr. John Sheliak with us. We'll talk about consciousness and quantum physics and shamanism and transformation, sort of the overarching theme that we're going to be talking about tonight. And speaking of the archives, there are a number of interviews that John and I have done in the past which are there and available for you to download and listen to and share with anybody that you like. But very great stuff and interesting stuff that John and I have talked about, I don't know, probably three, maybe four times now over the last couple, 3 years or so. So anyway, I'm going to play one more quick one here, and then we'll come back with Dr. John Sheliak, and we'll spend the rest of the evening talking with him about who knows what, okay? So we'll do it, and I appreciate you listening. Once again, this is a band called the Bean Growers. They're from the island of Malta, which is in the Mediterranean, I guess. And I was introduced to them by a listener, and I'm glad that I was, because I think their music's great, and this girl's very cool. So check this out. This one's called Quaint Affair, the Bean Growers. You're listening to it, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Thank you. called A Quaint Affair. Once again, the Bean Growers. And you're listening to it on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. This is Radio Orbit. And I would like to say hello to everybody and introduce to y'all my guest of the evening. His name is Dr. John Sheliak. He is a PhD physicist, educated where, John?
Michigan Tech and the University of Michigan.
All right, Michigan
and,
Tech.
And a short stint at Indiana University.
All right, I'm figuring to let him fill in the details. But John's been on the program a number of times before. He's a close friend of mine and a remarkable fellow. And we're going to talk tonight about, I don't know, sort of whatever strikes us. We're fortunate enough to have John actually here in Columbia, and it's a thrill to be able to look across the studio and have him gazing right back at me, and I don't know, I'm excited for the show tonight, John.
It's my pleasure, Mike. It's wonderful to be here, to be able to have a conversation with you, see Columbia again, and really engage the frontier as it is today, and see where we go with that.
All right. Well, let's start off with your trip. You've been traveling a little bit, Omaha, and then now here. I'm always thrilled to have you come here in June. We do this thing around solstice time every year. You were here last year, and it was a real fun and really just a super experience in a whole lot of different ways for me when you guys were here. And anyway, I'm thrilled to have you back in town. What are you traveling for any other particular reason?
No, this is the reason. Actually, you know, I needed to get away from New Mexico. It was time, but you know, I've been planning this trip here, you know, for months. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I booked my flight I think it was back in February. So that was settled then. And I have a daughter that lives in Omaha, and she has a practice in Chinese medicine.
That's right.
And I love to visit her.
Yeah, Donna.
My daughter Donna. She is 13 Moons Acupuncture in Omaha. She's doing great. So it's always wonderful to see her and, you know, the small communities that she's connected with. And, of course, this time my granddaughter, Nicole, also happened to be there.
Oh, that's right. Hi, Nicole.
So, it's also wonderful to have her with me. So this has really been a kind of a family engagement in a multitude of ways. I mean, it's not simply my biological family, but, you know, coming down here is like being with family.
No doubt.
Last year, you know, the connection that we made during the trip here and just being able to celebrate the solstice and feel the fellowship present and presence was a wonderful experience for me and one that I really value, and it's good to be back here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd like to talk for a couple minutes about Kent, if you don't mind.
Of course.
Speaking of the fellowship, he was the patriarch of sorts, at least in my world, and the guy that was super important to me and really helped me set my own compass many, many, many years ago. And I was thrilled that you and he have had a chance to become friends, actually, over not a real long period of time, but it was intense over the period of time that you guys did know each other. And I know Kent thought very highly of you, and he appreciated the conversations that he had in private with you, you know, over the winter. And anyway, I just want to recognize Kent and say how much that I miss him, and I wish he was going to be with us this year as he normally is, but you know, he's not, and that's sort of the way of the world. But I don't know, what are your thoughts on that whole thing?
Well, I was, of course, really stunned and, you know, not necessarily shocked, but I was disappointed that Kent, you know, had to leave when he left, because I was really looking forward, you know, to reconnecting with him,
yeah,
you know, this solstice, because, you know, we had such a wonderful connection, and we formed a bond that I felt was one of brothers, and it was really good to be able to have that kind of connection. You know, and he what I liked about Kent is he brought sort of an which I like in general. You know, I don't like communities where it's mutual admiration, where people are just sort of talking up their mutual values, ideas, and philosophies, and it goes nowhere else. I like communities that are diverse, you know, age diverse, philosophy diverse, you know, diverse in terms of the parts of the country people are from. And, you know, Kent, you know, brought this interesting energy, you know, to this community, and that I really valued. You know, he was a bear of a man with a big heart, wonderful soul, and a spirit that just radiated. So I really enjoyed, you know, meeting him and being present with him, you know, last year, and having contact with him throughout the year. And you know, felt a lot of pain when he left us.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was talking to Wendy, who will be here actually this weekend, but she had listened to the last show that Kent and I had done, which was only a few days before he died. It was like on the, I think we talked on like the 14th, and he died on the 19th. At any rate, we were talking about Missouri and about coming here this year, and he said, well, I'll find a way to be there one way or the other. And I tend to think that he sort of will be there one way or another if I know him, and he'll be watching us from a hawk's nest across the lake or something like that.
Of that I have no doubt. You know, I feel his presence already, and the fact that you mentioned that Wendy will be present says something to me. It's special.
Oh, me too. I'm really excited that she's going to be here and bringing Kent's daughter Leah with her. Leah's a real special young lady too. So, anyway, okay. So enough of the sentimentalities. Let's get on with what we have to deal with here, the living, unfortunately.
The challenges of the living.
The
right?
Challenges of the living and the requirements of biology and all this sort of thing, right? Which I am hoping to overcome somehow. I don't know. You know, John, before we came on the air, when we were sitting at the bar having a drink, we were talking just sort of casually about what we would talk about tonight. And our sort of general theme we agreed upon was this one of transformation. And it's a really powerful word, and I think it's one that is used frequently but not really paid attention to the gravity of what it really means. And we're going to talk about it a lot tonight. Would you do me a favor and give me a definition, the way you look at it, as far as what the word really means, transformation?
Yes, it's an interesting term that is often used sort of cavalierly. Mm-hmm. You know, people who... because it sounds nice, you know, and it sort of takes many of us out of the present state we might happen to be in, which may or may not be a pleasant one. But, you know, one of the things for me that's important about this process, it's just, you know, personally, what is happening with me? The state that I find myself in with all of this is one which, how do I describe this? I have this experience of elements, features of my life scattered throughout the different areas, you know, that I inhabit, whether it be work, my family, close connections in other parts of the country, philosophical kind of bits and pieces, detritus and memes scattered about the place, and I'm thinking, you know, where is all this? What happened? Where is all this coming? You know, what does this mean, and when is it coming together?
Mm.
You know, the metaphor, you know, and again, these things are used so cavalierly sometimes and it's so common, people just think of them as nice ideas, but, you know, have no relevance to life. But the metaphor, and, you know, it's one that's been used a lot for me that is relevant for my process, and I think, you know, the planetary process, you know, and at work, in the works right now, is that, of course, of caterpillar to butterfly.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know how many people out there know the specifics of what that metamorphosis of caterpillar to butterfly is all about, but it's actually quite interesting and significant, and I think, you know, has features that one can easily translate into one's personal day-to-day experience by paying a little attention and holding the image of that particular metaphor, you know, in mind and in heart-body, as you know, as we go through each day and have to deal with, you know, the ordinary and the non-ordinary that all of us are experiencing right now. And here are the features. Here are the essential features of that metaphor. The caterpillar, a ravenous creature who's eating itself into oblivion, you know, in a relatively small, confined part of the planet. You know, it would be essentially, you know, an ecologist's nightmare, you know, if there were too many of them, because they eat themselves basically into oblivion, into effectively what becomes a stupor.
Yeah, we lost a tree, actually, because of a small nest of caterpillars in one tree, and they took the whole tree, and it did not bloom this year. It's dead.
So, you know, that's sort of the beginning phase of this metamorphosis that happens. And so the caterpillar now is in this kind of stupor, chrysalis cocoon, and it begins dissolving into what is effectively an enzymatic soup.
John, what makes it make it? I mean, is it just a life cycle thing that causes it to make the cocoon to begin with?
Yes, you know, it's somehow genetic, but, you know, it's an interesting, you know, genome, because with a caterpillar, you know, as it's undergoing this metamorphosis, its immune system, or what's left of it, you know, is, it attacks and kills new cells that are forming that are called, interestingly enough, imaginal cells.
Imaginal cells, right?
Or imaginal buds. So you have a creature that has eaten itself into this stupor, wanting to hang on to dear life, to that particular life and form, you know, through its immune system, trying to kill off what is trying to emerge. That's a creature of an entirely different order, different range, different lifestyle, different perspective, and all of that.
Mm.
But what, fortunately,
so the body of the caterpillar is literally fighting against itself.
Yeah, it's at war with itself, effectively. Mm-hmm. You know, it's effectively at war. New or old immune system, old order, fighting for dear life at all costs to hang on to what it has.
Mm.
New order emerging in the form of imaginal buds or cells that begin eventually to link up, you know, to such a degree that the immune system of the caterpillar can no longer overwhelm them, you know, and basically
they take over.
Yes, exactly.
And then their genetic map then is the one that becomes the dominant one, and that then defines the way the unfolding of the next stage will take place.
Exactly, right. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever the genome of these new imaginal buds that eventually link to form the new organs of what will eventually become a butterfly. And, of course, a butterfly is a very different creature. You know, travels light, essentially doesn't eat, you know, travels far and wide. You know, it has a completely different experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a creature of an entirely different order, you know, than a caterpillar.
Yeah,
yet it comes through the same, you know, genetic soup, and I don't think that, frankly, that is yet fully understood, you know, how that really happens.
Mm.
And so the issue for me, of course, is, okay, that's a nice, it's a nice, in some ways, warm, fuzzy metaphor, you know, and we know what happens with one creature on planet Earth. But if that, in fact, is the process, as some people are suggesting, that's happening on a planetary scale, how's it going to manifest? You know, what would I look for around me to say that, hey, you know, this could be evidence of this process happening
on a larger scale?
On a larger scale, you know, with humanity and effectively, of course, you know, the entire population of planet Earth, all creatures, and the planet herself. But I can't get in the head of other creatures, other human beings. You know, what I have is my experience, my perception. So through that, how can I experience, you know, this process, if it in fact is happening?
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's the primary question I ask myself, you know, which of course leads me to actually self-examination and looking at what's happening day to day in my life. And, you know, how's this process unfolding within me?
Hmm. All right, look, it is the bottom of the hour, and we're going to have to take a little break, okay? We'll do that. We'll play a piece of music, and then we'll come back and we'll talk more about transformation and the way it ties into some of the other work that John does professionally and privately. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we'll hear a quick one here from the Bean Growers. This is the title track to their most recent CD. It's called Not in a Million Lovers. I love this stuff. Check it out. The Bean Growers. It's KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. You listen to it on Radio Orbit.
You don't stand the
The Bean Growers. All right, that's called Not in a Million Lovers. That's the title track to their most recent CD. Great stuff, and you can check them out on the web at beangrowers.net, and you can link to them from my music page, and you can also check them out on MySpace or whatever, I'm sure. But great stuff from the island of Malta. They're in the Mediterranean, and I don't know how I got that, but whoever sent it to me, thank you, because that's great stuff. Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. The City of Columbia Parks and Rec Department will present free family entertainment at the Twilight Festival in Flat Branch Park on Thursdays during the whole month of June. On the 19th, from 6 to 8 p.m., Sally Burnley will lead a family-friendly drum circle, and Sally will provide the instruments and energetic, friendly encouragement. Come and enjoy the experience of creating some music together down there at the Twilight Festival on Thursday night, okay? All right, it is Mike, and it's Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. My guest is Dr. John Sheliak. On the web at John Sheliak, S-H-E-L-I-A-K, johnsheliak.com. And he has a wonderful website with lots of interesting tunnels and links and rabbit holes to find yourself. And anyway, we'll say hello again to John and back to it. Hey, John.
Hi, Mike. It's sort of like life, you know, the website. Yeah. It's my life at this point.
Well, I tell you, if it's anything like mine,
full of rabbit holes.
Yeah, yeah. No idea where it's leading. But anyway, hey, you know, before the break, we're talking about the butterfly and the transformation that a caterpillar goes through as it becomes this new creature, right? And you mentioned that you look for clues and hints and evidence in your own world that this might be happening on a scale that has to do with us and with the planet in general. And I'd like, because you're a physicist and a mathematician, I'd like you to talk a little bit, if you would, about the fractal nature of, well, nature, I guess. Uh-huh. Because it seems that that sort of evidence right there to me that, you know, we do tend to see things on the smaller scale, and if we look close enough, we find out that they seem to happen on larger scales as well. Could you talk about that a little bit?
In the context of metamorphosis.
Yes.
Well, it's interesting because, if you think about fractals and self-similarity, self-affinity, similar or identical patterns at every scale, you know, of existence.
Give people a simple example, like an electron in a solar system or something like that.
Exactly. Or, you know, if you look at a snowflake, I don't know, I think almost a lot of people, maybe nearly everyone, has seen a photograph of a snowflake.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the overall pattern, it has a certain shape to it. Then you look at one little part of that flake, and you know, it looks pretty much like the entire snowflake. And you can look at any smaller feature of a snowflake, and you see the same pattern you see as you do when you look at the overall snowflake.
So you zoom in, you zoom in, you zoom in.
Same as coastlines. You know, you look at a coastline, you see a certain pattern. You zoom in at, you know, higher magnification, and lo and behold, you see the same pattern. You zoom in more, and lo and behold, it's the same thing.
Huh.
It, you know, it doesn't change the scale, gets smaller, but what happens is you have the same pattern. There's something inherently fundamental about the patterns in nature. And, you know, in fact, you know, that's Nassim, who you've talked to.
Nassim Harman, yeah, from a resonance project.
I mean, you know, patterns are essentially how he has decided to look at grand unification.
Yeah.
In other words, look at patterns in nature, you know, everywhere.
I think he's doing really interesting
Not simply in physics, mathematics, but, you know, what patterns have emerged in human history and experience.
Right, in systems in general, too.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Right. So there's something very fundamental and powerful about patterns that exist in nature. And the fact that you see in fractals something that exists, a repeating pattern at every scale, you know, is a fundamental feature of nature and the cosmos. And as you pointed out, you look at the cosmos, out at the stars, and you see similar features.
Mm-hmm.
You see, galaxies that have certain, galaxy clusters that have certain patterns. You look at them at higher magnifications, you see galaxies. I mean, the pattern's repeating all over the place.
That's crazy.
So,
I mean, that to me is just such a mind blower to begin with. I mean, when you really think about it, because I mean, why?
Yeah. So let's take that to the metamorphosis of caterpillar to butterfly. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, what is that pattern about? Well, it's about an old order dying off, giving, yielding to a newer order, a higher order, but not without a hell of a lot of resistance. I mean, there's an enormous amount of resistance that this old form has, even in the caterpillar, that life form, mm-hmm. to giving up, mm-hmm. and to letting go and to giving over to a higher order. So for me, I say to myself, okay, you know, that's nice for the caterpillar. How has it happened within my own life? You know, I'm not a caterpillar transforming into a butterfly. So, what are the elements that one looks for in one's individual life that are that pattern? You know, the pattern of the metamorphosis of caterpillar to butterfly, and the fact that the old form hangs on for dear life, and yet a new form is emerging.
Hmm.
Somehow, in that code, that genetic code, there is a preference, a strong preference for this new order that's emerging. It's so strong, that's what happens most of the time. And so it's important, I think, if we're really going to bring this home and make it meaningful in our individual lives, how is it going to manifest? You know, as I pointed out to you when we were having conversations, you know, one of the things I experience personally right now is this periodic war that's happening within me. You know, it's as though an old order is hanging on and there's a new order trying to emerge. What form that, you know, that will take, who knows? I mean, will it be physical? I don't know. Perhaps to some degree, and to some degree it will have to be physical. But certainly, go ahead.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that for a minute, because My intuition, my sense of things is very similar to yours. I mean, my own life, I have similar struggles, and I do feel like there is something happening in a physical sense, though. And I'd like you to address it maybe a little bit. In other words, the caterpillar goes through a physical transformation, literally, as we just talked about, and it almost kills itself as it's making the transformation. And in fact, some of them, I'm sure, are successful in killing themselves.
Correct.
And some of them don't make the transformation. And I think that's an interesting observation that we needed to pay attention to, because that's sort of the way evolution works. Not everybody makes it, you know. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is, are we potentially going through physical changes in a literal sense, internally, that we may not be aware of, DNA tweakings or genetic things that are happening inside of individual people that will eventually, if you know the metaphor is correct, will eventually take over and then create literally a new type of creature, a new being.
Well, let's take a look at what we know, you know, with this whole process. We have essentially an economy in free fall. We've likely reached peak oil or close to it. Oil prices aren't going to get any cheaper.
Yeah, $140 a barrel.
No, climate change is a reality. You know, the political process we're seeing is unlike any. I mean, we talk about these things. I mean, these are things that are happening. We also have a field, I don't know whether it's in medicine, physiology, or whatnot, in which a group of people are actually taking seriously the fact that we are not victims of our genes, mm. and the fact that there are ways through diet, lifestyle, and a number of other factors, relationships, that one can actually affect how a gene expresses itself.
Yeah,
these aren't notions, yeah. New Age notions. This is hard science that's happening today.
Do you know Bruce Lipton, Dr. Bruce Lipton?
Yes,
he wrote with it. Biology of Belief.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, he was a famous microbiologist, but now he's right in the same circles as you're talking about,
right.
And basically environmental, and you can affect your own genes by the neurochemistry and the environment that they're swimming in, essentially.
Essentially, and here's what it's really about. It's called down-regulation or up-regulation. In other words, you can actually down-regulate the expression of bad genetic feature traits, you know, and you can up-regulate. It's called, you know, an expression of what we consider positive traits, things that are expansive, healthy, happy, that kind of thing.
And you do it through diet, especially?
Diet. Diet,
meditation,
diet, meditation. Mm. Relationships are very important.
Right.
You know,
are you aware of the changes? Are you consciously aware of the changes?
What they're talking about, these studies that have been done are statistical, in other words, and I think in part some are done with patients that are heart patients, cardiovascular patients, so they have a population, you know, that, you know, does the normal medical treatment. They have the population that does, you know, the treatment that involves diet, lifestyle, relationships are really an important one, forming the right kinds of relationships.
Well, I mean, Lipton made it really clear when I talked to him, because he basically said that, you know, we are responsible for our own internal chemistry. In other words, our bodies regulate our own chemistry, and the way that the body regulates the chemistry is basically has to do with neurotransmitters. And if you got your healthy good ones going, you know, and you're happy and you're in good relationships and healthy relationships, your body will be swimming in a certain type of chemistry. And when you have negative relationships, if you're afraid, if you're, you know, if you're being abused, if you're being deceptive, and most people lie, you know, in their relationships. Well, if you do that stuff, well, you release different chemistry into your bloodstream, and that chemistry directly affects the genes and their expression.
Apparently, big time.
Yeah, the big time, man.
Mm-hmm. You know, so these are features, you know, related to some type of metamorphosis that are about physical changes in physical traits, mm-hmm. through the manipulation of the genome in some way or another. How far can that go? You know, we really don't know. But if in fact, you know, what we are experiencing is some type of metamorphosis that's comparable to what we just described, then it will most certainly manifest in specific ways that are detectable, at least measurable, perceptible, mm-hmm. by us, our consciousness, and our bodies. And I think that's what I'm talking about. You know, how in our own lives, I mean, can we ask ourselves, you know, if I were to stand back and look at my own life process, can I identify features in my own being, consciousness, attitude, behavior, that are about what really feels like an old order in me that's struggling to hang on? I think if we're all of us honest, you know, in that self-examination of that type, we can say, yes, I can identify features. You know, from an old school perspective, when we say, sure, I mean, that's like identifying, you know, our shit, you know, the things that we need to change. It may be more fundamental than that. You know, maybe the things that we need to change about us are not simply behavior traits that we picked up along the way, but there's something fundamental that's related to an old genetic form that needs to change. Hmm. You know, and of course the flip side is, okay, you know, if I can, you know, through some kind of self-examination, and maybe it's this process that involves, you know, I think each of us has to, and this is one of the things, I don't think there's any general prescription or philosophy that can be overlaid on all of this. You know, I bring mine to the table, my experience, my philosophy, but, you know, each of us has, you know, our own experience. And I think if anything like this is happening, it surely must involve the integration of all of our experience in some form or fashion. But I can also identify those features of my consciousness, being, attitude, behavior, that I clearly feel are related to a higher order within my own being. You know, so for me, the important thing is, because we are conscious beings, you know, to consciously take an active role in shifting my awareness to those things in my life that I truly believe and feel in the depths of my being are about a higher order within my own life and life process.
All right. Well, something is going on, and my intimations come primarily from this relationship with psilocybin, with mushrooms. And I'm not the first to have an idea that, you know, that there's some sort of long, long symbiotic relationship between our species and that species that has to have genetic significance, it seems like, because, just the experiences are too profound to not affect your especially with what we know about what we're just talking about, the idea that your own consciousness and your own attitudes, etc., can affect the expression of your own genes. Well, when you throw something like psilocybin into the mix, I don't know what's happening, but my intuition is that something is happening, and that it has been sort of a partner in our evolution for a long time. You know, Terence talked about that pretty specifically, and extensively. So we don't have to go into that. But what you've had similar experiences, or as me, I guess, is a good way to put it, in your own way. Obviously, these are all personal things. But do you have any of the same feeling?
That's an interesting question and a topic that we could probably take the rest of the evening and much more describing, but absolutely. As I tell people, I'm a scientist. I do physics. I practice physics. But first and foremost, I'm a mystic. You know, shamanism for me is a path, is a life path. And it's one that's specifically related to my perception of the meaning of that in my life and how it manifests. And for me, it's as simple as this. You know, shamanism for me is about the power and primacy of direct experience, and my direct experience in nature and the cosmos, over the experience, attitudes, philosophies, religions of others. Not to say that I can't integrate some of the valuable features of others' experience into my life path. Mm-hmm. But first and foremost, you know, what governs my life and the decisions that I make, you know, it has to be, you know, my experience. So shamanism for me is an important part, and it has been for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And psilocybin is a part of the shamanic process, you know, for me. In this sense, it's not something that I chose to be, to have that role in my life. Frankly, it feels more like it chose me, you know, because something about that particular chemistry in that plant is deeply resonant with my neurochemistry and my body chemistry in a way that it was never a struggle for me.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it didn't take me to places that were pushing the envelope. You know. That certainly happened over and over again. But it felt to me, I mean, if you look at the chemistry, and Terence has pointed this out, you know, the chemistry of psilocybin, DMT, and the indole family are similar to brain chemistry. In fact,
very
DMT
similar.
Is brain chemistry.
Yeah, DMT is in each and every one of us, and almost in each and every plant and animal on the planet, it seems now.
And that's no coincidence, you know, as I said before, Terence certainly brought this, is where I heard it the first time, this coincidence is what you have left over when you apply a bad theory.
That's right, P.W. Bridgman, old science philosopher, yes.
You know, which is really true. So it's no coincidence that chemistry is so close, you know, as close as it is to neurochemistry.
Right, serotonin and psilocybin just a twist away
right.
from one another.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And DMT, as we say, is already there. It's in your brain already. The only thing that happens when you do a concoction like ayahuasca or smoke DMT is you're tweaking the levels.
Yeah, really.
Right, big time.
you're
cranking up the levels or whatever. But at any rate, I think that it's really interesting that these drugs, I mean, they call them drugs, but they're essentially neurotransmitters, they fit right into these particular receptors. I mean, they're obviously the brain is made to link up with these things, otherwise they wouldn't have the effect, and they wouldn't do what they do. And once they pass that barrier, you know,
not only link up, but you know, again, for me, I step back and I try to get some sense for what larger process, certainly for me in my life, is at work with this, and it's from my experience is that it's almost a field experience that in that state, I feel more like a wave than a particle. In other words, you know, what I normally sense is as the limitations of my physical or emotional being get expanded sometimes beyond imagination.
Mm.
And I think, you know, this is another feature of reality, nature, the cosmos, fractal nature that you see, you know. this kind of expansion happening in a way that you can't explain. You know, by simply dismissing these things as you know, artifacts of the human brain and neurochemistry, and you know, it doesn't mean anything; it's random. And you know, as Tanner pointed out, well, if you're talking to the troops, that makes sense. You know, but anyone who's been there, I mean, really been there, and I don't mean just you know having a casual social experience with it. I'm talking about somebody who's, you know, stared it in the face, gone in and said, okay, you know, I'm going to align myself. You know, this is a relationship I'm forming, you know, with all of the ups and downs that go with that kind of relationship, and really, you know, really, really be there. You know, it's like, you know, people who, you know, say, hey, bro, whom I don't know, you know, I say, well, you know, don't call me bro unless you've been there. It's that kind of experience, you know. And you know, Terrence was aware of this too with psilocybin psychedelics. You know, the experience of actually going there and understanding that these things, you know, have an extraordinary effect, and they feel like, you know, they're, you know, you're essentially changing something fundamental in your awareness and consciousness that wasn't there before. You know, it's not simply overlaying brain chemistry with a new chemistry and it gets all muddled. You know, your experience wouldn't be nearly as coherent if that were true.
Yeah, I have this the metaphor of the key always kind of comes to me, because in my own life I think that psilocybin has been a key of sorts into unlocking certain mysteries and questions that I had, and it certainly has posed many new questions. But I also actually, when I actually physically do it, about, you know, 30 minutes or so in, I can almost feel the psilocybin kicking out the serotonin, you know, and then snapping into that receptor, and it's like the key, literally like the physical representation of the key, because it fits right in there. It's like a key going into a lock. And then once all those keys are, it's like a tumbler, and you click, 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 and once they're all inserted where they're supposed to be, then boom, then whatever happens is going to happen. And I, to me, it's you make me think again the idea of like a radio receiver. We're doing radio tonight, and that's, it's almost like the psilocybin is like an antenna. Or a transceiver that tunes into frequencies that you couldn't get before, or something like that.
I think it's one huge bandwidth broadening mechanism.
Top of the hour, it's midnight. KOPN Columbia. We're going to take a little break with Dr. John Shelyak on the web at johnshelyak.com, and you can link there from my site as well. And we'll come back and talk to John for a couple more hours. We've got him live with me in the studio and a number of other people. Thanks, everyone, for coming down, hanging out tonight. And we'll get back to the conversation in just a few minutes, okay? In the meantime, we will hear another piece of music here from my new friends, the Bean Growers. This is a song that's called Ours is a Small Flat. All right, have a nice day. It is now the 17th of June, 2008. Back with you in just a few minutes. today. Once again, that's the Bean Growers, and that's a song called Ours is a Small Flat. You're hearing songs tonight from a CD called Not in a Million Lovers, and thanks to Luigi and the rest of the band for getting me that music. It's great to share it with my audience tonight. Okay, we'll hear more from the Bean Growers throughout the program tonight. We've got another couple hours here with our guest, Dr. John Sheliak, in the studio with me from his home in Santa Fe, now in Columbia, Missouri, and thereabouts for the next week or so. And it's a pleasure to have John back with us. And you can check out his website on the web, at on the internet, at www.johnsheliak. Every time I try to spell Sheliak, I say ace. I don't know what. He's an ace. That's why. Anyway, John Sheliak, S-H-E-L-I-A-K, johnsheliak.com. And a very interesting website with lots of things for you to check out. So anyway, we'll get back to John and say hello. What's going on there, John?
And again, it's great to be here. It's wonderful to see you again and have this chat. I wanted to pull together something I started to say about fractals, since you were in fractals earlier. And the fact that you see patterns, we see patterns in our lives, and of course, in the cosmos and nature in general, at every scale. I thought for some time, thinking about these things. At one point, I was thinking about the wave and particle nature of light. Light has a wave and a particle nature. A wave nature is something that has it spread all over space. Particle nature has it confined into a certain region of space.
Is that what a photon is? They call
a photon
is a particle,
right,
of light.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. And when I thought about that, I said, it feels to me like we do as well. I certainly feel that I have a particle nature and on a wave nature. I have a part of my nature that's well defined. My body, personality, certain. You can go through it and you can see certain features of human behavior and biology, et cetera, that have very, very specific features, well-defined.
Yeah, particle features.
Exactly.
Right.
We also have this wave nature, part of us that seems to be spread out all over space and time. So this
consciousness,
this image, exactly. Consciousness, what we were talking about earlier,
right.
Broadening bandwidth.
Right. What about even, the fact that the human heart and the brain, but the heart in particular, gives off a very powerful electromagnetic wave,
of course.
Right?
Right.
And that doesn't stop at the skin.
No.
Right?
No. Technically, it spreads throughout. It gets very weak at some point, but it can spread out through all space.
Right. I mean, once it goes.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point is that you see this is pattern, particle wave. That's pattern. I mean, if you look at it, as a pattern, does that pattern repeat itself, at higher scales? And I think it does.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about the experience of psilocybin, for example, you see what I think is a powerful example of our wave nature. At least that's my experience, and that there's this tremendous bandwidth broadening that happens that really spreads me, my awareness, and sometimes it even feels like my body, although, I can't claim that, but certainly my awareness and throughout all space and time.
Hmm. Yeah, my experiences are similar.
So that's fractal. That's part of this same pattern occurring at all scales.
At greater scales, right, and smaller scales.
And smaller.
Up and down.
Right.
Remarkable. Okay. All right, I have a question that came up at the break that... since we're sort of at a good place to make a transition into something else, I have a friend on the web saying, Mike, at some point, if you get the chance, please ask John about how his new Time Wave software is coming along. He knew that was going to come up sooner or later, so here you go.
I haven't had or taken a lot of time over the last couple of months to really do the kind of development that I really want. But before I left for this trip, I did take a look at what was happening with 2008, because I had a friend who's an astrologer, who asked me, hey, what do you think is going to be happening in 2008? I thought, I'd like to see whether the time wave through wavelet analysis would actually show something. I have on my graphs or the time wave software that I'm writing a feature that analyzes the wave in terms of wavelets. I don't want to talk too much about or go into too much detail about that right now, but basically it produces a graph that's sort of like a topographic map.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at it, And if everyone has seen a topographic map, basically it shows you a map of the terrain of any environment, so that you have hills, valleys, etc., elevation. This particular graph shows that. But what that means is that on the lower axis, x-axis, you have time, just like the normal time wave that Terence described,
mm-hmm.
historical time. In this case, it's the period that includes 2008. On the y-axis, you have what's called scale. In other words, at what frequency do the different features that appear in the time wave show themselves? And what I saw with this graph, and I was hoping to upload this to my site so people would take a look at it while I talked about it, but unfortunately it didn't happen. So I can't talk specifically about what this graph looks like, but it is just covered from one side to the other with these what would essentially be mountain peaks on a topographic map that began early in the year and continue all the way out through the end. I really don't know what that means. You know, I'm not at a place where I can make any specific claim about what that means, but I find it interesting that so much seems to be happening in 2008.
Hmm.
Not just so much, but huge so muches are happening in 2008.
Hmm.
It has me so intrigued that I really want to go back and say, okay, now it's time for me to bite the bullet and really, you know, do the development on this I really need to do. And I would really like to be able to complete that this summer,
right.
So I could say, hey, you know, here's
right.
what's going to happen,
well,
folks.
I think it's important that you do. I've thought so ever since you and I met. And for a little bit of background, for those unfamiliar with the time wave that John and I are talking about, this was a concoction of the mind of Terence McKenna back in the early 70s. And working with the old ancient Chinese oracle, the divination book, the I Ching, and a particular, was it the King Wen sequence.
Right.
Anyway, Terence was able to come out with some underlying mathematics that seemed to define the way the I Ching actually worked or operated. John was able to greatly help Terence with regard to the theoretical math that the time wave actually eventually became popularized for. And so this is a legitimate mathematical theory that has been now out in the world for 30-some years. Of course, it's been tweaked a little bit here and there, but it's up for scrutiny. In other words, anybody who is a mathematician can go look at it, and they can decide whether they think that it holds water or not. But I think that has been determined. And I know enough. I have a bachelor's degree in mathematics. I know enough to be able to understand that it's not poppycock. I tell you that much. You know, when I read the work, and I think that enough people have looked at it now that there's not a whole lot of argument that there's something there. Obviously, the mathematics behind the I Ching is legitimate. There's no question about that, right?
The mathematical expression of the particular feature of the I Ching that Terence used is absolutely legitimate. It's
right.
It's the proper way of, I think, expressing what he intended to express.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what Terence essentially did was to take only one feature. You know, the I Ching, for all of those, you know, who don't know much about it, has several mathematical features that I won't go into. But one is, you know, the feature that Terence chose to develop. And that is the number of lines that you change as you move from hexagram 1 to 2 to 3, etc. In other words,
all the way through the series.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he, through his shamanic practice, you know, developed, you know, a theory that's based on this particular mathematical feature that he expanded into a larger, essentially, number set, which was expanded into an even larger number set through what was termed a fractal expansion. So
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
what he essentially did was to take one feature, mathematical feature that the I Ching exhibited, and expanded that in part through piecewise linear mathematics, and then, you know, infinite series expansion that was a fractal expansion, and which gave him the time wave that, you know, most people who have seen it are aware of.
Okay. All right. Well, so anyway, I just want to let people know that this is a very serious piece of work that took many years to develop, and John was involved in the sort of the solidifying of it as far as the mathematical ground on which it stands. And I'm always indebted to you for the work that you did and the help that you gave to Terrence, because you really did bring something to the table that he really needed badly, and I've thanked you before, but I really want you to know that, John. I think it was very, very important, and I think that it's going to become more important as we move closer toward the end of the wave, because I mean, my intuition, and that's basically what I go on these days, my experiences, as you mentioned, and my own intuition, and I think there's a damn good reason why you're still interested in the time wave, because it is important, I think, and I think that it's going to help us move into this sort of uncharted waters that lay ahead. But 2008, you know, back to that topic.
Look what we've seen already.
I'm at a loss for words. I mean, I can't imagine what the rest of this year is going to bring.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know, I can't speak obviously for Terrence, but just during the time that I knew him and had conversation with him, my impression was that he believed there was something real going on with this. I also think that he didn't quite know. I mean, he had some help expressing it mathematically, but he also knew that and actually said this more than once, that he really hoped that people would become engaged with this. Mm-hmm. That peer review and criticism was vital and essential.
Right.
And he, I think, really hoped that people would get interested and be able to develop this theory. People mm-hmm. who had the mathematical skills to actually take a look at it and say, or even theoretical skills in physics or any field of science that may apply, and say, hey, look, that's an interesting idea, and this is what intrigued me. It was an interesting idea, and I just thought, I wonder what would happen if I used some of the tools that I use and the work that I do apply to this. Uh-huh. Could I see anything? Because it's intriguing.
Remarkable. Well, that whole story between you and Terrence and how that whole thing came together is just an amazing thing. I mean, talk about synchronicity. And this is another thing that I'd like to bring up and maybe ask you about. The concept of synchronicity, meaningful coincidence, these signposts that Carl Jung talked about. Terrence, in novelty theory and, of course, in cooperation with the time wave idea, he believed that synchronicity would increase and then become off the scale increase to the point where it would become excruciating, Well,
singularity.
Yeah.
He thought of it in terms of a singularity.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm finding that more and more in my own life. Are you experiencing significant increases in synchronicity, or do you think it's all in our minds, or?
How do you define that?
I guess everything's in our minds, right? I mean, that's the whole business.
First and foremost, all I can really know is my perception, mm-hmm. my experience. I can really make no claim that any of that applies, that's general, or applies to any other being.
Mm-hmm.
When I find common ground, and this is effectively how science really works, where it works best, it's not that it proves anything, but it works such that, the perception of one person or a group of person say, hey, we have this experience, let's correlate that with other experiences and see if there's any common ground. But ultimately, it's just people getting, saying, okay, I've had that same experience. There's no proof in the sense that people think of proof. This is absolutely cast in stone, not arguable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
All we're saying with science, and I think with our own experience, is that, this is my experience. And, we engage one another, we interact, and we try to share as best we can what those experiences are. And every once in a while, we come up with something, hey, there's something here. It's greater than I am, mm-hmm. because somebody else is sharing it. And I think that's where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to value that and to go with, this whatever sense of direction we have. And you know, Terrence, you know, was a pioneer, I think, in that respect. Like he just went out there and did it and said, this is my experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anybody else having this? let me know.
Right. I think
because, you know, it's something that's so extraordinary, you know, it just boggles the mind that, you know, it's not on the front pages of, you know, every newspaper.
It's the weirdest thing to this day. I, you know, a couple of years ago, the Hopkins did the study that was basically the repeat of the Leary study that was done in the 70s, you know, with psilocybin. And again, rave, you know, the scientists all say what a wonderful thing this is and that people should be using it for purposes of, you know, personal transformation and, you know, and self-help and all this sort of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. That it's for psychiatrists and psychologists that it's essentially a wonder drug, you know. Harvard then did the study, UCLA did the study, everyone does the study.
Right.
But it never makes it to the mainstream, you know what I mean? And it's still lied about with regard to the legality, to the legal status of it. There's just propaganda that pretty much runs the show with regard to the psychedelics in general. And I guess I'm just... I'm still very curious about it because the data is in that... Of course, with all things that are serious, you have to be serious with them. I mean, you know, if you have a tool, well, and that's what these things are, you got to know how to use the tool correctly, you know. And I appreciate that. But the tool should be made available to use, you know what I mean? It's like buying a power drill or buying a table saw. Well, you got to know how to use your table saw if you're going to build a nice table. You can cut your arm off, but you still... can go by the table saw.
Well, there are a large number of natural tools out there that essentially are our birthright.
Mm.
Let's go to let's talk just briefly again about this issue of, is it just in my mind or, you know, is it real?
Mm.
Well, what does that mean? You know, what is mind in that context?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, how does any of us define reality? You know, do we define it by, you know, the pain or joy we feel, physical pain, emotional? I mean, how do we define what's real and what's not? Do we say simply, you know, if I prick myself and bleed, that's real, but a thought that may be part of my mental or mystical process isn't real?
Mm.
You know, where do you draw the line?
Right.
And, you know, how do you say, you know, and of course, we now know, I mean, there are increasing numbers of experiments to say that mind does affect matter.
Mm.
You know, maybe at our current level of consciousness, individual mind has a very slight, you know, almost imperceptible effect on matter, but it's there.
And some greater than others, apparently, depending on the mind, right?
Right.
Hmm.
Apparently, right. You know, so, you know, let's be careful about how we define mind or reality in our lives, because we tend to be very, like our culture, very, very, very narrowly focused in terms of what we're allowing to be let into our notion of reality.
Right. It seems to me that we're much more constrained by cultural convention and conditioning and this sort of thing than we are by actual physical law.
And very much so in some respects, for sure. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, I wonder what's going to give, because the culture, the society, the poor excuse for a civilization, and I shouldn't be so harsh on history, you know, because I do believe that it has a purpose, and I think that we're now moving toward the end of this particular phase because it's been as good as it can be, and it wasn't good enough. I mean, all you got to do is turn on CNN, and you'll hear everybody say, oh my gosh, the system is actually going to fail. I mean, they're actually saying this now.
Mm-hmm.
People are recognizing that the whole ball of wax, the economy is essentially a fraud. It's built on lies and deception and manipulation. That goes, and that's basically the same thing for all of the institutions if you actually get down and dirty with them. You know, if you take it to the mat, you'll find out. I had a recent thing happen with the University of Missouri. They just don't have the courage to go certain places, you know. And
well, again, you know, I really, you know, I might beat it to death, but I think it can't be, because if one uses the metaphor of caterpillar butterfly, you know, it makes sense, you know, that there is this enormous struggle of a creature that really served its purpose. Let's face it, you know.
So,
and this is what you're getting at.
Are you telling me that the institutions are sort of acting like the immune system of the culture and trying to fight off anything that would?
Well, I think, again, we're talking about a fractal, something that occurs at every scale.
I think,
there's no... I mean, each of us has to, you know, decide for ourselves. How does that feel? I mean, for me, that makes sense, absolute sense.
Right.
And, you know, the thing is, and this goes to what you just said about, you know, let's not badmouth it too much, because the caterpillar served its purpose, you know, in some important way, it brought us to where we are now.
Right.
You know, but... In my own life, you know, the same with my own life. You know, my experience up until now brought me here. You know, I once had a very long discussion with a good friend of mine in New Mexico, and I said, you know, sometimes it just seems to me that the assholes get away with everything, you know. You know, why is that? She said, you know, John, don't dismiss your challenges, struggle, or pain so easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they help make you what you are today. They brought you here.
Everybody has a role.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
And I think it's important to realize that, you know, so that we can, I think it helps us to move forward, say, okay, you know, you served me well, but it's time to move on.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to let go, you know. There's something better waiting. You know, and that's the real issue for me, you know. It's not like, my God, what's going to happen to this? You know, we're really, I feel very, and this is personal philosophy, it's not something that's hard science. You know, I really believe very strongly that we're all part of something so extraordinary that our imaginations can't begin to grasp it.
Mm.
And that's a process that's happening on planet Earth and the cosmos in general.
Mm.
And it's not a matter of faith for me. You know, it's a matter of something in my DNA that tells me that, you know. And it's been there as far back as I can remember.
Well, I'm reminded of the Jesuit Pierre Teilhard de Chardin.
Mm.
Right? He had a birthday just last week. I talked about him on the air a little bit.
Yeah.
And he was one of the few Christian, Catholic, you know, philosophers. But he was a brilliant, brilliant person, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, exactly.
Absolutely.
What I mean.
Right.
But at any rate, he did believe in you know, the idea of teleology, which gets laughed at by most people these days, whether you're in science or religion. But religion seems to laugh at their own prognosis, it seems like, because... the idea of teleology is that the universe does have a purpose, and that all of this is leading up to something that is that perhaps that transformation that we keep talking about. Anyway, I love the idea that the universe has a purpose. Otherwise, you know, what for? You know,
I don't. You know, again, I can't know what other people feel about this, but I know within my own, in the depths of my own being, heart and soul, there's a strong sense of that. You know, it appears at times, you know, as though it's permeating every cell in my body. It appears in dreams. I mean, I don't know how many dreams that I've had over the course of my lifetime that are deeply affirming of a larger process that we're all embedded in that is, you know, whether one calls it a purpose or not, it's certainly a process that's one of expansion, integration, and deeper connections with, you know, others and the features, the parts of nature and the cosmos that are part of us and that we're deeply embedded in.
All right, look, it's the bottom of the hour now. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about the way the universe has complexified over time, and why we think that's good evidence to support our theory of transformation here, okay?
Sounds good, Mike.
All right, everybody. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, on the web, kopn.org. And, of course, my website, www.mikehagan.com. And my guest, John Sheliak, Dr. John, on the web at johnsheliak.com. All right. It is about 12:30 now on the 17th of June, 2008. We'll hear one from the bean growers here, and this one is called This one is called Untitled Forever. Back just a few minutes. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. Untitled Forever, that's another one from the Bean Growers, from their most recent CD entitled Not in a Million Lovers. Good stuff from the island of Malta in the Mediterranean Sea, and it's a pleasure to share that music with y'all. Okay, on the web, beangrowers.net. It's Mike, you listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Hello to everybody listening out there, live or otherwise. If you hear this program from the archives, hello to y'all too, okay? And we have some people listening on the web, I think, in Omaha and out and about. So hello to all you listen to Dr. John tonight, all right? Okay, look, before we get back to John Sheliak, let me say that we are having a party at my place on the 21st of June, this Saturday, at the place we like to call the Shire out there in Roachport. If you want to come, just go to the website. There's an invitation on the front page there, and I'll put the map up. I still need to do that, but you can send me an email or whatever. It's easy enough to get a hold of me, and I'll give you the map and instructions on how to get there. But anybody who listens to this radio program, you're welcome to come out there as long as you're a decent person, you know. Be nice when you come out there and all that. That's all we ask. And you're welcome to share the fun with a whole bunch of really cool people that'll be there from noon until sunrise probably on Sunday. So anyway, you're all welcome, and I certainly love to see and meet listeners to the program. And there'll be a whole bunch of interesting characters there that you can mix it up with, okay? All right. That is this coming Saturday, the 21st, all right? Let's see, what else do I have to say? Today, the 16th of June, is the anniversary of the birthday of Geronimo, the Apache medicine man and amazing warrior. His name is called Goyatle in his own tongue, and he was a remarkable person and someone who I like to remember. If you don't know much about the history of that man and his people, certainly worth checking out. All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. All right, we've got Dr. John Sheliak with us in the studio here, and we will say hello again to John.
Hi, Mike. Right, great to be here.
Yeah, it's all so cool having you here in the studio.
Yeah, it's a wonderful experience to have.
Hey, let's talk about the universe and the way, for you know, just for sort of practical purposes here, the way it has complexified over time and the reason that we think that it's still happening. I remember Terrence used to talk a little bit about, you know, two things that science didn't pay a whole lot of attention to. And one of those was that the universe is complexifying over time, and the second thing is that the complexifications occur quicker and quicker after the preceding one. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, this is, of course, what we think we know about an evolving cosmos, but...
Right, we don't know much. I mean, we can admit that. But
what we think we do know, you know, what we see, if you follow the cosmos as it's really evolved over the time that we're aware of, at least...
And this is by looking deep into the past with big telescopes and this sort of thing?
Yes, right.
Okay.
Right. Looking as far back in time as possible, as we can. So what we think is that, you know, it essentially... Well, yeah, this is the beginning, of course, is where you get... Initially, nobody had any theories. It's like, that's the domain of God, and we don't touch that.
Right, so the beginning.
It just sort of happened, and as Terrence said, you know, this miracle happened. We won't talk about that, but we'll tell you what happened afterwards, right?
Yeah, and that's still
true.
You get
this free miracle. I really like how he used to describe it. You get this one free miracle, well, then we all get one, right?
Right.
But, you know... Right. You know, actually hard science is making some attempt to kind of, you know, explore that. And in some respects, it's interesting because it essentially acquiring more huevos and actually saying, you know, we're not going to leave this to the domain of religion alone. You know, let's, you know, get some courage.
Try to come up with some ideas.
Let's kind of explore this, even if it takes us into this mystical domain that, you know, was no man's land for science and physics, you know, only 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially you start out, you know, as a sea of quarks, you know, and in fact, there's a theory that says that the amount of entropy that, you know, that's increasing, the potential entropy is much less than the actual entropy. In other words, there could be more entropy that is disordered in the universe than there actually is. And that difference, the fact that there is, in some measure, far less entropy in the cosmos than there could be, you know, is what's called free energy. And that's what's really responsible for the tremendous organization that we see. You know, where did the energy come from? In other words, well, it came from this, the fact that... you know, the cosmos developed in a way, and it usually is associated with this rapid expansion or inflation that occurred. You know, that just sort of upset the apple cart, and you know, and pushed things far enough apart that that they could no longer, you know, equilibrate to a degree where we end up, you know, with nothing more than a sea of quarks or fundamental particles. So what you see, you know, you see from this potential sea of quarks, you see atoms, you know, forming, you know, to form molecules, to form essentially elements, and then elements to molecules, and basically evolve into stars, galaxies, you know, planets with life, intelligent life, etc. And I think the argument is, for those who say, you know, there seems to be a strong indication of purpose or an evolutionary process, it's about integration, interconnectedness. In other words, if you take a particle, bring it together into a larger particle, that's an integration. In other words, two separate parts coming together for a larger purpose. It's also interconnection, you know. And so at this point, you know, the argument is, well, this is how the cosmos seems to have evolved from the beginning of time. Simple elements combining to form more complex elements, combining to form more complex, etc., until what you get is self-reflecting life forms on planet Earth. And, you know, according to most, you know, most scientists who having a particular axe to grind against, you know, intelligence elsewhere, you know, given the size of the cosmos, you know, we're certainly not the only one. It's probably ubiquitous throughout the cosmos. And the only argument that people have is, look, and this is what's happened until now, you know, what indication is there that it's going to change, you know? Is it going to stop? Why should it stop? You know, is it your hope that it will stop? Or is it actually something that's part of the process, this evolutionary process that says, okay, at some point in time, this evolutionary process that's been at work for 13 point so many billion years stops. You know, it doesn't happen anymore. So the issue then becomes, okay, if it continues, you know, what form does it take? You know, how does this increasing level of interconnectedness and in higher level integration, how does that, again, how does that occur, and what form does it take?
Well, yeah, I think that's an important distinction to make, because even a lot of the scientists that I talk to on the air, and if you read evolutionary biologists, a lot of them speak about evolution as if it were through. They look at it in sort of like the nostalgic sense, you know what I mean? And they talk back about it as if it was something that occurred and it's all nice and everything, but now here we are and we're basically the final product or whatever. And I think that is such a naive perspective, because...
And arrogant.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, again, if you have some of the things that you and I have experienced, you know that evolution is alive and well, and it's pushing very, very hard right now, it seems.
It seems, for me, it seems like it's going, you know, full throttle, you know, certainly locally in this part of the cosmos. You know, I don't, you know, for me, it doesn't, I don't have any issues with the fact that this is happening, and it's happening in a large way. Well, that's my perspective and my experience.
What about the fact that evolution is usually, well, at least from what we know, it appears that evolution picks its pace up as pressure builds. Evolutionary pressure against a particular species or whatever will cause that species to change relatively, well, it'll cause it to change more quickly than if there weren't the pressure.
You know, this whole issue, you know, for me, is where I part company with, you know, many who see, how do I say this, you know, a cosmos that trying to find a concept to come up with this, but you know the evolutionary pressure, you know, that we see is part of what I call the gradient nature of the universe. In other words, you know, people say, you know, you hear it, I don't know if it's so much in the New Age, you hear it a lot in different circles that polarity is a bad thing, that somehow polarity we've got to overcome, you know, the... From my perspective, polarity, you know, is exactly what we need, you know, because it's gradients of the polarity, it's the differences, the diversity, the gradients that really drive this evolutionary process and this creative process, mm-hmm. you know, within us as well as within the cosmos.
Right.
So
right.
I say, you know, let's bring on the gradients, let's bring on, you know, the differences and the polarity, because they're really what, you know, helped to create this universe as it is, an extraordinarily beautiful design and experience, to, you know, something to behold.
And without the polarity, you have no frame of reference to recognize that which is beautiful, too. You know what I mean? In a way, it's
yeah.
like how I have a friend who talks about, you know, that recognizing the horrors that actually exist on the planet is it's not necessary to dwell on it, but it's helpful to recognize that there are things that are that are nasty in order to be able to experience the other side of those things. In other words, you can't recognize beauty without seeing things that have been pretty tragic, you know.
You know, that's, you know, something that's very likely, you know, true in many respects. You know, but again, I think not to demonize polarity and, you know, gradient, because, you know, it's these pressures, you know, whether you want to call them evolutionary pressures or, you know, physical pressures or emotional pressures, all of these things, you know, are moving us, you know, and you can say pushing, but it could be pulling, it could be embracing us and carrying it along with it. I mean, there are many ways of looking at the kind of pressure you're talking about, or polarity, or gradient. You know, I think it gives us a cosmos that's filled with beauty and wonder. You know, without it, we have a sea of quarks and a very cold, uninteresting cosmos.
Mm-hmm. All right, CERN. We're sort of talking about the scientific side of this. And you mentioned that the scientists are getting some more huevos and actually trying to come up with some ideas of what may have been going on in the very early moments of the universe. Everyone's concerned, and, well, not concerned, but a lot of people are curious about CERN, this big giant particle accelerator in Switzerland that's apparently getting very close to being activated, or maybe it already is, I don't know. But
very close, I don't think it's quite yet,
yeah.
Very close.
Well, anyway, please... You have a unique perspective, being a physicist as you are, and I appreciate your comments on CERN and what you think is going on.
Well, you know, as you said, it's an attempt to recreate conditions that existed in the early cosmos so that we can gain some level of understanding about what might have happened. You know, I'm sort of neutral on CERN because, you know... I'm not convinced that we're not at a point in our history, in our historical epoch, that may make facilities like CERN obsolete, and with more meaningful theories and perspectives emerging. But you know, there's one feature. Well, a couple of features. You mentioned that computer systems, you know, needed to be developed, you know, to be able to handle something like this, the kind of data. And just the control system, you know, are phenomenal. That's really too, and I, that really advances technology. But does it by itself advance consciousness? Which I think, really, from my perspective, you know, at this point in history, we're at a place where technological advance is going to be taking second place to what I think is basically an advance in consciousness. I think we really need an expansion of consciousness to be able to handle any technologies that are going to be meaningful, you know, to a civilization, you know, that's emerging.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought too, because with regard to pressure that we've been talking about, the technologies that we've developed have been, whether it was purposeful or not, have been a part of that pressure. In other words, we've developed technologies now that have created a situation that's sort of untenable. I mean, in lots of different areas of endeavor, and we know that now. And I think that you're right, that consciousness as it is cannot handle the tools that are now in its hand.
Precisely.
And so there's only two ways out. One is kaboom.
Extinction. Let's move forward.
Or let's move forward and figure out a way to use the tools. Right?
I think so. And, you know, so when I look at CERN, you know, it's a mixed bag for me. You know, and some part of me says, you know, even though there may be interesting physics, you know, is it really going to contribute significantly and substantially to what, you know, all of us are experiencing as some kind of transitional process that happened. And it almost seems, you know, like, to me, it's almost like, and this is just something that I have an instinct for. It almost seems like, you know, a candidate doesn't want to drop out of the race, you know, after, you know, that candidate, you know, knows there's no chance of winning, you know, that kind of thing.
You know? Well, there's budgets involved and careers at stake and all
of
kinds
course.
Of ego.
Absolutely.
And coattail riding and,
exactly.
You know, and there's a big bit of that going on. And I've always been, you know, I've always been a little questionable about this type of stuff, only because, you know, people tend to think when they read the stories or when they hear people talk about CERN or whatever that something's actually being observed. It's really not. It's really just a bunch of data that's being generated, and then a bunch of fishy formulas that are sort of agreed on by this little priesthood. And then I just don't really buy it, you know. I mean, because nobody can. I mean, you know, I don't know. It seems a little bit fishy to me.
Yeah,
that's
well,
all.
I think what makes it seem fishy to a lot of people is how it's often practiced. I mean, there's so much arrogance, you know, in the scientific community, you know, and you know, a lot of people know this. This is not news. You know, if it were dished out with a little humility, it would be much more easy, you know, for I think many of us to open up to these ideas and say, yeah, if people could say, well, we're not sure this is what's happening, but, you know,
right.
You know, this
right.
kind of, it's like what I was saying earlier about my personal experience. All I know is my perception, my experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, science is so often institutional science, and, you know, and science that comes from ego is so much based on, you know, I have the right answer. You know, it's like it's become a religion in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I have the answer, you know, there's no argument. And, you know, end of discussion.
Right.
I think it's that attitude.
Right, science to scientism.
Yeah, as though somehow, you know, we're so bright and resourceful that we've really got to a place where we kind of figured it all out, you know, and there's not much to do, you know, so we can just all kick back and watch our, you know, 36-inch
plasma TV.
Plasma TVs and, you know, not worry about it anymore.
Hmm.
If you believe that, you know, as Terrence once said, I let the people, well, I got a few bridges to sell you. I certainly don't.
I had a question about CERN.
Hold on. What mic is that? Go ahead, sir.
Okay, yeah, I when you were speaking of CERN, and it just dawned on me that, is there a danger that that large installation of an electromagnetic cycle could start a gravity vortex or some kind of energy vortex associated with the gravity function of the planet?
And, you know, I've heard that. And, you know, it can't be ruled out. But I think we're talking, if you're looking at like mini black holes, you know, Nassim believes the cosmos is, you know, I don't know.
It all runs on black holes, essentially.
You know, I mean, all over the place.
Right.
So, I mean, they're not really any threat until they get it to be a certain mass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it capable of creating something that would be so massive to create that? I really doubt that. You know,
yeah.
I you know, and again, I'm one who you have to understand the context of this for me. You know, I'm a scientist. I practice science, and that's what I do for a living. But as I said to so many people, first and foremost, I consider myself a mystic. You know, and that is someone who makes an effort to develop relationships with the deep mysteries of space-time, the cosmos, existence, you know, human life and whatnot.
Are you familiar with the phenomena associated with a mining accident of a large lake in Kentucky, I believe, in the south, where there was a company driving pilings in the bottom of this humongous reservoir, and they broke through to a cavity which was a mine underneath this lake, and it created such an incredible vortex of drainage that it drew the ocean in through the river before it could balance out again, before it could...
I hadn't heard of that. I wasn't aware of it, no.
And I don't know that... I'm trying to think of the incidents with the name of the lake, but I recall seeing a video of this on YouTube. Perhaps someone could call in and remind us what the name of that situation was.
But I personally don't think there's, as energetic as CERN is, there's nearly enough energy, you know, to create a gravitational well that's significant enough to do anything, you know, more than our individual, the gravity wells of our individual bodies might do with one another. But, you know, it in some respects, you know, none of us know what can happen with something like that because something has not been done. Anytime we embark on something that has never been done, you know, all we have is our past experience and our theories to guide us.
Right, right.
You know, that's it.
Right, right.
So nobody can tell you what's going to happen. Nobody. You know, and I can't. I just based on what I know in terms of the energy there, I doubt that it can create anything that's going to be, in the way of gravitational well, it's going to be significantly or a threat to anyone. But, you know, I don't think we really know the answer to that.
They do have an off switch, right?
I think they do. Yeah. I think that's the thing with technology, you know, as far as we know, it has an off switch.
There's a breaker somewhere, I'll tell you that much.
Although, if
about a million amps or something, but...
although, if what you suggested is correct, Mike, the most significant part of CERN is, the huge computer system that was developed. You know, who knows? Maybe that, is, the first cell of a new life form.
People should look into that. If you Google CERN and then computer system or something like that, you'll find that they had to develop this remarkable new computer technology that was required just to handle the data that's going to be generated from the experiments. And so there have been tremendous advances in the computing technology that they're using there. So anyway. It's interesting for sure. I'm sort of with you. I sort of look to the past and say, maybe they'll get another particle and they'll name it after someone, but it won't really mean a whole lot to me in my life, whether it's a muon or a Higgs boson or whatever. I'm still.
Maybe they could just call it Patricia.
Well, let's see.
Wait, one of the things, one thing to add to that. I mean, when you're dealing with complex systems or nonlinear systems. Theory or nonlinear systems, you have what's called emergent properties. In other words, you can have in a complex system something emerge that's greater than the sum of its parts. That's always a possibility in any system that's complex enough, which means that you can't predict exactly what's going to emerge, from a system that gets complex enough. So in that respect, it's really... anything could happen, but I think the probability is slightly low.
Okay. All right, let's take a break. We're just about top of the hour here, and we'll take a breather, come back, talk a little bit more, okay? Everybody, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Dr. John Shelyak on the web at johnshelyak.com. You can link over there to his site from my site as well from here on out. And, of course, there are a couple of three, four, I don't know how many shows in the archives that John and I have done in the past. We will play another piece of music here from the Bean Growers. We'll take a nice little 5-minute break here and come back and talk with Dr. John Shelyak in just a few minutes. Once again, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. This is the Bean Growers. Thank you.
one's called Captain Darling, the Bean Growers from Not in a Million Lovers. It's Mike, you listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 1 a.m., 4 or 5 minutes after that, now on the 17th of June. And it's a pleasure to be with you all tonight. And we've had the privilege of sitting down with John Shelyak and talking with him for the last couple hours. We'll have another 45 minutes or so with John in just a few. But let me mention that the website is www.mikehagan.com, H-A-G-A-N. And John's website is www.johnshelyak.com. This program will be up in my archives in the next 24 or 48 hours or so. And so if you miss the live broadcast here, you can podcast or download the MP3, whatever, and share it with your friends, okay, if you find it interesting. Also, the music, great stuff. If you like it, let me know and let the band know. Beangrowers.net, great stuff from the island of Malta, okay? All right, it is, once again, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And John Shelyak is back with me in the studio here. Hello, John. Thank you for sticking around.
Good to be here.
Yeah, I got you now. You can't really go anywhere. You can't hang up on me.
Right.
You know, I guess you can leave, but you're not going that far. You're staying real close to where I'm at.
Out in
beautiful Roachport. It's so cool that you got the bed and breakfast there in town. That's awesome.
It's a wonderful place.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's see. I want to talk a little bit about Cold Fusion. We were speaking off the air, but I had a real interesting conversation with this guy named John Bachrus. Dr. John Bachrus is like 89 years old, a physicist from South Africa, but his career was primarily here in the States. And the way I was introduced to him was he's a friend of Dr. Rustam Roy at University of Pennsylvania, or is he Penn State? I forget, whatever. And we were talking about cold fusion, and he said, well, you should talk to John Bachrus about cold fusion, because I was excited about this Japanese experiment that had just been done, and I thought that it was big news. And he said, well, it's really not that big a news. You know, I said, well, yeah, you know, another group of scientists has confirmed that they have been able to accomplish this, and they've documented it, but the same problem still arises. And this is what Bachrus brought to my attention, was that, yes, there have been successes in cold fusion documented that have happened here in the United States, and they're not that uncommon, really. But his statement or his position was that the major problem is that it's unpredictable, and that you never knew when it was going to work and when it wasn't going to work, and it didn't work more often than it did. And first of all, I'd like to ask you just about your opinions on cold fusion to begin with. We'll talk about it a little bit, and then we'll bring time into this whole thing and talk about maybe where we might be able to come up with some new answers, maybe.
Yeah, sure, Mike. Well, just a kind of a brief tutorial about cold fusion for those who really don't know what it is. Fusion by itself is simply taking the light element hydrogen, you know, which is, you know, abundant in the cosmos, bringing it close together, you know, so that the atoms are close together, giving it energy, enough energy, and that energy is used in the form of vibrations. So if you can see, you know, look at two tiny balls being pushed together and given kinetic energy, you know, by heating,
right,
you know, when they collide with enough energy, they'll fuse, and that releases energy, and it comes out in the form of a high-energy neutron and a byproduct of helium. And stars do this routinely, you know, through massive gravitational force. We're trying it, the hot fusion, essentially using high-energy lasers.
That's something that you're working on, actually, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Using high-energy lasers so that you take a fuel, hydrogen fuel, push the atoms close together by compressing it with a high-energy laser beam or number of beams, you know, that are being focused from every direction onto a spherical target that's filled with hydrogen fuel.
Wow.
And what you do is, so you push that, you compress that hydrogen so that it's all, the atoms are in close proximity, and of course the laser also gives, you know, transports heat, which excites the atoms such that they have enough energy when they bang into one another, they fuse and produces energy.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, with inertial with this type of confinement. Well, you have to confine the atoms into a small space and give them enough energy so that they, when they collide, they fuse. That's the principle of fusion.
Right.
With cold fusion, what you're doing is you're using a metal lattice. In other words, you use a metallic lattice to confine the hydrogen. So you confine it into a metallic lattice and then add some electric current, which gives it the energy, that's necessary for it to fuse. It's a combination of density and the amount of energy you have to put in, So you don't have these high-energy lasers in cold fusion. What you have is a metallic lattice that confines, the atoms so that they're in close proximity. Pons and Fleischmann were the first to claim this, what was it, 20 years ago?
Yeah, 87 or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. And when they did, the fusion community was puzzled by the fact that this happened because they didn't really understand the mechanisms. And so they went about setting up experiments. I mean, there were experiments all over the country to see if they could measure anything happening. And, as far as I know, nobody really measured any neutrons. However, there was still a small community of people who were very much interested in the physics because it was something that hadn't really been studied from a physics point of view. I think Pons and Fleischmann, they were not physicists, they were chemists, and I forgot, basically. So, certainly interesting physics. So to hear that it's possible that fusion reactions have been seen with it, is not necessarily something that would be out of the question. Of course, it may be possible. People thought there was something going on. The issue is, as you pointed out, can you do it every time you try it?
Hmm.
And how much energy is really coming out? Right. The energy is going to come out in a fusion reaction of that nature in the form of a neutron, high-energy neutron, and you can measure that. So if this, I hadn't read about or heard about this experiment, so it'd be interesting to kind of look at
it. I'll send you a copy of that interview.
Yeah, I'd like to.
You'd like to hear.
If you can, it's very interesting physics for sure, but can you get enough energy out for the energy, cost that you put into, making this happen? That's
mm-hmm.
really becomes mm-hmm. the issue.
Mm-hmm.
You need gain. You need lots of energy out compared to what you have to put in, to get it to fuse.
Right. Okay.
And, so we'll see what, again, I think, there's a lot of general, arrogance in the scientific community in general. My philosophy has always been, let's keep an open mind and an open heart and let's see, if people can show evidence of something, let's be open to it.
Right,
why on earth do you want to say, that's not possible based on my theory? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe your theory is, wrong,
right.
Basically.
And we need a new theory.
Exactly.
Well, this brings us to a point of contention in science in general, and I think that the cold fusion problems that people are having with regard to repetition of the experiments, or they can repeat the experiment, they just never know when they're going to get the good one. This brings us to time and the... one of the a priori assumptions, I think they call them, of the scientific method is this thing they call return to initial conditions, right? And it essentially means that experimentation is time independent.
Correct.
That you can do an experiment anytime you like and you should still get the same result. And it seems to me that this cold fusion thing might be pulling the curtain aside a little bit to show you that that's not necessarily the case. And this might be something that has to be done at the right time in order for the thing to work. And your work with regard to the time wave and the fact that you're a quantum physicist and all this other stuff, please talk a little bit about time and if we're getting to a point in science where time has to be brought into these equations.
It could very well be. As I said earlier, I think, we virtually don't understand time. In fact, this has been quite a while ago. There was a conference, I think it was in Spain, in the late 80s sometime, and where it was, a conference that was largely about quantum mechanics and the developments of the, at that time, the recent developments in quantum mechanics or quantum physics. And the discussions actually evolved into a discussion of the nature of time. They were actually seriously debating, you know, the nature of time. So this is not something, you know, that's New Age or that's out there like, you know, we know what time it is. There's nothing debatable here. It is debatable. You know, we just haven't paid attention to it because it's something, you know, we figure, well, we'll get around to that later. And, you know, we're able to do a certain number of experiments where time appears to be, you know, a constant. Uh-huh. Even though through relativity we know that, you know, time has features that are not constant.
Right, right. And even from a physical point of view, in other words, the moon is always in a different position. The planet is always in a different position with regard to the stars, etc., as it's moving. And I think those subtle influences may be playing a bigger part than people are actually giving them credit for.
And absolutely. What about in our perception of time, the human consciousness perception of time? We all know that time appears to pass differently at different times and
right.
different circumstances.
Right. We've been on the radio for 2 hours and 50 minutes. It seems like we just began to me.
Exactly. So, I mean, this is a feature of time that we virtually ignore when, in fact, it may be a fundamental feature of time that needs to be examined and, you know, brought into theory.
Well, if time isn't a constant, though, that's a huge monkey wrench for the scientific method.
It's a monkey wrench for the scientific method and theories and the worldview we currently have. Mm. However, it may be a way of breaking through to a worldview that's much more
accurate,
hyperdimensional, and more accurate, and more to the heart of the nature of reality.
Huh. You know? Very cool. So. Very interesting. All right. Well, let's see what we got going on here on the website. Mike, what does John think of the cetacea? Do you have an opinion on dolphins and whales and that sort of thing? I know there have been some that have been beaching themselves recently, and I'm not particularly interested in. I mean, unless you'd like to comment on what you may think is happening there, but
well, I don't know. But I think it's interesting in the respect that, you know, why is, you know, do we have any handle on why this is happening, you know, or why so many frogs are dying out? I think these are interesting questions, but I don't think anybody knows. Well, there may be some who know, maybe not. But you know, it's an issue that needs to be addressed, an issue that needs to be addressed. I don't have answers for it. You know, I'm certainly interested because, I mean, these are, you know, according to some, maybe more intelligent than the human being. You know, may have consciousness and intelligence that perhaps surpasses the human race. But aside, that speculation aside, you know, it's, I think it feels, you know, tragic to me that these things are happening and, you know, that it's possible we may have some responsibility for it.
Have you ever been in the water with a dolphin or a whale?
No, I haven't.
I'll tell you, that's something else. Looks like your granddaughter has here. Yeah? Hold on, Nicole. I want you to say hi. Say hi.
Hello.
Tell me about your dolphin or whale experience. And pull that microphone down a little bit.
I used to live in Florida, and I actually went out in the ocean in a boat. I didn't swim with them, but I got to see them swimming on the boat with
wild
them.
Dolphins, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they're remarkable, and one of the things that... hobbies that I took on early in life was I learned to scuba dive at a real young age. Like I was 13 years old when I began diving, and I haven't been able to dive much in the last 10 years or so. But when I was younger, before I had a family and all that, oh my gosh! And I've had experiences underwater with these things, these creatures. That I mean, you know, it's they're all there, baby. They are all there. You know what I mean? And they're certainly different than we are, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they're sentient. I'm sure of that. I mean, I've felt that absolutely clearly. And I mean, you can see it in their eyes. And they're very interested in us, I think. And because we're probably, we're having some impact on their world.
There's no doubt about that, you know, in terms of sentience, as I said, you know, they may very well be far more conscious than human race is.
Mm.
You know,
they've certainly been around for a long, long time, and they have the brains to sort of back up some of these ideas.
Yeah, and one of the features of sentience, of course, feeling, you know, part of what sentience means is, you know, feeling beings.
Mm.
And it's difficult to argue when you look at, you know, the behaviors of dolphins and whales, for example, that they're not feeling creatures.
Yep, certainly. All right, let's see here. Well, what do you got on your mind, John, as I snoop through the chat room here? A lot of people saying hello.
some folks are going to be coming out for the party on Saturday.
Wonderful. I look forward to seeing or meeting.
Oh, yeah. I'm all excited about it. I've got Thursday and Friday off of my regular work, so I'm planning on using those couple days to get things ship-shape, you know, over there at the... at the homestead, but
the Shire.
I was thinking that you're going to be around. I was thinking you're going to be around for like 3 days to help me.
Mm.
I was going to like enlist your, you know, services. But he's not. He's coming back.
I try to be part of that, though. Nonetheless,
well, I'm sure we'll have plenty of help. What do you got going on between now and Saturday? You're doing a little bit more traveling, right?
Heading back to home for a bit, just doing a little kind of, you know, I need some kind of downtime for myself, just to relax and unwind, maybe explore Omaha a little bit. You know, my daughter Donna's been there for, I think, 5 years now. And during my visits, I sort of get, you know, the usual tour, but I'm kind of interested in just being on my own to explore some, as I have here,
mm-hmm.
just to get a feeling for the area in general, what it's like and, you know, what's happening. But I also need to rest, need a break from everything that I've, you know, been engaged with over the last few months.
Right. All right, a lot of people asking about the software for the Time Wave. Is it going to be made available, a version for other people that they can download and mess around with themselves?
That's certainly my intention. You know, my intention is to do that, and as soon as I possibly can. It's really in a form right now that would be difficult for the general user, you know, to make sense of it. You know, it does produce what the original Time Wave Zero produces. It's still in development, and, you know, I need to get to a place where people can make sense of it.
Okay, all right. John, there are a couple people that are asking about the telephone. Do you mind if I open the phones and see if anybody wants to call and talk?
Sure,
talk with us? All right, if you'd like to call in and talk to Dr. John Shelyak, you can do that at area code 573-443-8255. That's 573-443-8255. I'll keep my eye on the phone here, and if you call, we'll get you in on the conversation, okay? All right. Quantum physics and consciousness and...
a whole other animal.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that's, again, right in the middle of the stuff that we've been sort of dancing around all night.
Well, for me, it's, you know, it's an essential part of everything we've been talking about, because... you know, unlike some, I don't think that we need to overturn everything we think we know about the nature of what we're part of, what's part of us. And I think that, you know, quantum mechanics, quantum physics may actually be revealing of some essential features that, you know, being aware of will help us, you know, to sort of navigate, you know, whatever territory we need to navigate. But the essential feature, of course, you know, with quantum mechanics is what I call, and what is now being called, the unified field or the quantum field. It's the fact that through this principle of non-locality, that is, if you interact two photons or electrons, separate them by any arbitrary distance,
mm-hmm.
can be on the other side of the universe, interact with one, its former partner responds instantaneously. Mm-hmm. That is infinite velocity. And there's an infinite interaction, no matter the distance, between two particles, photons, electrons that have been correlated or interacted.
Is that Bell's theorem?
That's part of it.
Okay.
And, you know, through that process, since every particle in the known universe at one time, we think, was contained within the volume of a dimer of a proton, everything was interacting.
Hmm.
That means that today... everything and everyone in the universe is in contact instantaneously through this unified or quantum field. That means that within each of us, we have access to everywhere and everyone in the cosmos. We are fundamentally linked. That fact, that principle, is not, you know, in question. You know, it's not controversial. What's controversial is, you know, how does that scale up to human awareness? In other words, how does our awareness interact with this vast field, sea of information that we're all embedded in?
Hmm. Yeah, that's the big question.
And, you know, and again, that's a question that people are making a serious effort to address. you know, the experiments that have been done are being done with mind-matter interaction. You know, how does mind interact? You know, can my mind be shown to interact with matter? You know, and then a number of experiments that show that, in fact, it appears to be, you know, mind can interact with matter.
You know, who was so ahead on the, ahead of the field on that was Rupert. It certainly was.
Yeah. I mean, that was part of it. You know, there's also, of course, the egg experiment that's being done at Princeton.
Yeah, that's a trippy thing.
Right.
Tell people about that who aren't familiar with that. It's the random number generator.
Yeah,
the egg
exactly.
Thing.
I don't remember exactly the details, but basically, you know, a random number generator is going to spit out random numbers, and there are ways of actually measuring that. I mean, that's not something that's difficult to do. And if it fails to do that, you know, in response to some stimulus, there's something going on. In other words, if random number generators cease for an instant, you know, to be generating random numbers, then something is causing that to happen. You know, of course, the simplest random number generator, of course, is throwing the dice, you know, throwing two dice and coming up with numbers, you know, or flipping a coin, you know, where you get one of two. I mean, randomness is just saying that what's the probability of outcome, you know, given the nature of the system. With
right.
a coin, you
right.
know, heads or tails, 50-50, you flip it enough times and you're just going to get a 50-50. You know, you're going to get heads 50% of the time, tails. Random number generators, you just spit out a sequence of numbers, you know,
right.
and they're in any sequence. There's no pattern whatsoever. You can't find any perceptible pattern, and there are ways of measuring that.
Uh-huh.
So what they've done at Princeton, you know, with a number, well, it's not just at Princeton. I think they've scattered them throughout the planet. And they call them eggs, right? Yeah, right. They monitor the number sequences these things are generated. And when there's a significant planetary phenomena, you know, I think... whether it be an earthquake, a huge, massive earthquake, and I haven't seen what results were for the recent earthquake in China or the tsunami, but significant planetary events, even the O.J. Simpson trial, for example, in this country, appeared to affect the randomness of those generators. So clearly there's an effect, you know, and the larger the consciousness base, in other words, the number of people involved, the greater the effect.
Yeah, I remember that on 9/11 they went wacko, the whole Princeton thing.
They did, absolutely, yeah.
Or prior to it.
There were two features. One was a precursor, almost like a
predictor or something.
Yeah, right,
yeah.
As though, you know, some part of humanity was anticipating this, you know. Ahead of time.
I imagine there were a few that were, yeah.
Well, there's another feature with this, and I don't remember the precise details, so I can't really report it accurately. But, you know, there have been experiments done that, you know, show a mind matter interaction across time. In other words, in the past. So there's this feature, you know, quantum feature that allows one, you know, this interaction, you know, across time barrier. Again, we get back to this whole issue of what is time? You know, is it really the animal we think it is? And clearly it's not. But, the interesting thing is we're getting at it indirectly, you know, because for most scientists, that is such a taboo, you know, that it would be a career suicide, you know, for them to say, you know, I'm really going to, you know, spend my career making some headway with time.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, like through these experiments and what you mentioned earlier, with the cold fusion, it may be, you know, coming our way whether we like it or not.
Right, right.
You know, I don't know.
John, we've got a call here, and let's see what they got to say, okay? Good evening. Welcome to Radio Orbit. Who's this?
Hey, it's Lance. How's it going?
Hi, Lance. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. You got a question for John?
Yeah, well, it's probably not much of a question.
Hey, Lance, do me a favor. Speak up a little bit. We don't have the best connection. I know you're in British Columbia or something like that.
That's true. It's probably not the best question, but I want to ask him about Brown's gas.
Brown's gas?
Yeah, well, the Japanese just came up with a car that's running on it, and they've got a little portable go-about thing that they've got going, and it's splitting hydrogen and oxygen from water, and what are the technologies that are leading us down those paths? Because I've seen some incredible things with Brown's gas. I know a couple people that have welders, and you can hold the flame to your arm, and it doesn't do anything, and you can tease it down your arm to the tip of your finger, but you have to move your finger so fast if you have a chunk of tungsten at the end, because it'll burn. The tungsten melting will burn your finger. The flame won't.
Huh.
So I'm wondering if your guest has any information on Brown's gas.
Well, we'll find out.
I don't. It's intriguing. Can you tell me a little bit more about it, what you know about it?
Some guy named Yule Brown discovered it in the early 70s, I think 72. He's an Australian. And it's a particular way of sending an electrical charge through the water so that the hydrogen and oxygen separate. You capture the gas, and then you use that gas to burn things. But you can actually, you can melt tungsten with it, but it won't burn your arm.
You know, Lance, that's really similar to the work that was just recently confirmed by Russell Roy. You know, remember that guy John Canzius in Florida, who's running
the guy that was looking for the cancer cure.
Yeah, and he's running a low RF current or a low RF wave through salt water, and it disassociates the hydrogen and oxygen, like you said, and it burns.
Well, you know, a really interesting thing is that in the one of the
and that's been published now, by the way.
It is published.
Yeah.
One of the museums in Ottawa, in Canada, the capital of my Kanakistan, as I like to call it. the Canadian government spent so much money on Brown's gas, and they sold all of the information that they got to the Chinese, who I guess are running some of their submarines off of it.
Oh, God, figures.
And the first Brown's gas generator that the Canadian taxpayers spent like $250,000 on sits beside Glenn Gould's piano in whichever museum it is in Ottawa. I think there's like 7 museums in Ottawa. You know, what can you do? Glenn Gould is like a Canadian cultural icon, and right beside him is this piece of technology that people are starting to redevelop in this way. That's
remarkable.
Okay, radio frequencies, and like the way that you split it normally is just you have like 9 volts and you just split it. That's how you do the welders and whatnot. So I was just hoping that maybe the guy.
Huh. Well, we'll certainly a story that we'll keep up on. Okay, Lance.
Okay.
All right, man. Thanks for the info.
Yeah. Nice chatting.
All right. Cheers.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about that, but one of the things that I'd like to make listeners aware of that, you know, in the scientific community, not everything that's being done that can be considered physics or science makes its way into the mainstream science community, mm-hmm. you know, for lots of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that I hadn't heard about. It's interesting, but I would have to really know more detail to, you know, to make any intelligent comment about right. what it means.
All right, cool. Look, we got one more short break we have to take, okay? And then we'll come back and we'll have another 25 minutes or so with Dr. John Shelyak, and we'll wrap up this radio program. Stick around. You got Ruth coming in after me to play some music for you for the next few hours. And in the meantime, I'll play another one for you myself. This one is called Love Can Do You No Harm, and it's the truth. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. We'll be right back.
can't do you no wrong. That's the Bean Growers one last time. Actually, we'll hear one more song from them on the way out at the top of the hour. But anyway, you heard it there from, once again, Not in a Million Lovers, the Bean Growers on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 24 minutes before 2 a.m. now. Again, it's the 17th of June, 2008. Dr. John Sheliak with me in the studio live tonight for the last few hours. It's been a pleasure to have him here with us, and it's just a blast doing these shows with the guests in the studio. I really get to do it, John. Normally I've got you or whoever else on the telephone, and it's great to have you in the studio.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
You're welcome. It's great to have you on the show all the time, and I have a feeling we'll be doing another radio show before the end of the year. You know, I talked to Dennis McKenna,
yes,
just yesterday, I guess it was, and he's on the way back from Brazil in the next couple of days. But he'll be interested in doing a radio show toward the end of the summer or into the early fall. He said that the three of us could get together, you and he and
love
I.
It.
So that'll be a lot of fun, and people, you can look forward to that. I should actually tell folks a little bit about next week. Yeah, well, I'm just going to do the show by myself next week. I don't have a guest. And the party's this weekend, and I'll be off work on Monday, so I'll just come in and probably play some music and tell you about how the weekend went and all that stuff. And one other guest of note that I want to mention before I leave tonight is Harvey Arden. He's a Lakota elder who is doing wonderful work and somebody who I've been wanting to have on the program for some time, and he'll be on the 14th of July. Brooke Medicine Eagle back with us sometime in the next few weeks. Howard Middleton Jones, Susan Weed, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, who John's familiar with. She's amazing. Wow. Holy cow. Halton Arp, a really interesting astrophysicist, an old astrophysicist that lives in Germany. So, anyway, good stuff coming up over the next few weeks. And right now we will get back to John Sheliak. And got about 15 more minutes, John. And I don't know, what should we talk about? I should open the phone lines once again, 443-8255 if you want to talk with us, 573-443-8255. In the meanwhile, what do you know? yeah, I know.
What I know.
I got one for you.
What I really know is that I know a lot less than I thought a week ago or a day ago, last month.
Yep, I'm learning less. I'm realizing more and more how little I know. So,
but the interesting thing about that is an extraordinarily expansive, you know, a feeling, you know, for me. You know, it's like
it's sort of both. You know, you realize, oh my gosh, I'm learning more and more, but at the same time, I'm realizing how little that I know.
I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Yeah, but for me, it's kind of a relativity thing. In other words, if one gets close enough to some large shift or large flow of information, then what you know by comparison is going to seem very small.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think so. It's not so much that I know less than I did, but it's more of a feeling that what the process is happening is taking me to a place where this information, the body of information will expand dramatically, and that makes what I think I know at the moment, you know, look right. Pretty small.
All right, I want to stick on the topic of energy for a minute. I had an email at the break where a listener mentioned that the atoms that make up our bodies are essentially all nuclear furnaces or something. In other words, we know that the power that exists inside the atom is a tremendous amount of power. We've seen that unleashed once or twice in the past, right? So we're made up of all these atoms. So potentially, we are walking nuclear weapons in a way. Right? And I'm curious about all that energy. You know what I'm saying? I'm
curious in what sense?
Well, I mean, it's enclosed in this skin.
How could it be released? Well,
yeah,
no, I mean,
or accessed, you know, or something.
Well, it's more than, you know, I mean, you've heard the reports and speculation about this weight loss that happens at death being related to, you know, the soul being released.
Has that been documented that there's
I don't know. You know, I mean, you hear it, it's rumored and you hear people talking about it.
Right.
I think it has been. You know, I think it's something that's somehow been measured by somebody, you know, whether that's been reviewed and, you know, shown.
Okay, so for argument's sake, okay.
Yeah. But those who I've heard claim it are reputable people, you know, they're not cranks. And, you know, whether their claim is true, I don't know. And how many people have been able to measure that? But certainly, you know, that's been claimed by, I think, reasonably reputable people.
Hmm.
You know, so I think, I mean, we are energy. And everything, you know, matter, and it's the acceleration gravity equivalent. You know, matter and energy are equivalent. You know, you know, the matter in our body can be converted to energy. And it doesn't have to be an explosive energy. You know, it can be, I mean, energy can be channeled in a way that's very creative and expansive, and you know, that's sort of how, if such an expression would happen, you know, from body to pure energy, I see that as a positive, you know, expansion of who we are.
Hmm. Wow, that would be something else. We all turn into stars or something.
Well, you know, there are cultures. I think, I don't know if you remember Terrence talking about this culture, probably in Iraq, you know, that believed that life process is about, you know, gathering light, you know, until you have gathered enough light and then essentially become some form of light being. I mean, there are cultures really believe in that, whose whole spiritual mystical practice is based on that idea.
Well,
you know, so where do these come from?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Where do these ideas come from? I mean, what has a human being think? You know, that in addition to this physical body, they're light. I mean, where? I mean, there's no logical path, you know, from what we think we know about ourselves to make that sort of an assumption. Yeah, right.
Based
on experience, except we're, you know, that it's coming from some sense or maybe, you know, who and what we are.
Right. The Egyptian culture, and I think the Maya to a certain extent, had a belief that, you know, when you died, you essentially became a star. And that's one of the reasons why the heavens were so interesting, and why they named all of them after their gods and pharaohs and all that sort of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have an overwhelming intuition about light being somehow involved in this transformative process that we've been talking about over the course of the night. And if let me ask you a question with regard to the transformation idea. What about the earth herself? Do you see a process of transformation happening with the earth too, where the earth becomes different in a way? Like, you know, as a butterfly would become the result of the caterpillar's change?
I think if one looks at whatever process may be taking place, there's something that involves, as we discussed earlier, a cosmos that's becoming more interconnected.
More complicated.
And more highly integrated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Integration implies individual parts coming together to serve a larger purpose. Why would you exclude the planet from which your physical form emerged if that were true?
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
I would think that it would have to include every feature of the known cosmos.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If this happens to be a relatively local process, then certainly I would think it would include certainly our planet, you know,
mm-hmm.
in some form or fashion. I mean, look, the planet is the basis for life as we know it. If that life is evolving, it seems to me that the support system for that life must surely evolve in some way or another as well.
Mm.
I mean,
right.
If you just want to get, go as far into philosophical grounds as you can, I don't see any reason why that wouldn't include planet Earth.
Mm-hmm. What about the fact that the light that's coming from, okay, we have these alignments that are coming up, or that we're in the middle of, really, that for all practical purposes, the 2012 alignment and lots of the stuff that happens in this window between like 1998 and 2012 or whatever, we're in the midst of it right now. And a number of people, including astrophysicists that I respect, say that as we move through these different sections of the galaxy, that the light, literally the qualities of the light that is impacting our planet, primarily through the sun. In other words, the sun receives energy from a galactic counterpart or something, and then the sun, in turn, releases energy out to us. And perhaps climate change and some of the other things that we're seeing on the planet are a result of just this different light. And, of course, different light means different type of energy.
You know, I think it all has to be in play because, you know, I don't think it's hardly been pinned down and well understood. But one of the things about, you know, automatically dismissing the human role in climate change is that, you know, it sort of goes to what is a pet peeve of mine, and that is the abdication of responsibility for our behavior on planet Earth.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, it may be a combination of things, but I think certainly there's a human behavior, a human civilization component to climate change.
I agree, the fact that
climate is changing, you know, I don't think...
Right, that's pretty clear.
Yeah, clear.
Yeah, and I think we have a part in it, too. I just don't think anybody really knows what the hell is really going on as far as the details.
Right. You know, so those who say, well, you know, solar cycles, you know, sort of take the blame, and the implication is it's not really us. Well, maybe it's both, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a combination of both. And in fact, if all of this is part of what I term the larger evolutionary process of work, then it surely must be, you know, all components.
We have
a role. I mean, we're certainly part of the process, and in our attitudes, philosophy, behavior are all ingredients. And
there's no question that we're transforming the surface of the planet.
Yeah, clearly.
You know?
Right. Look what's happening in the Amazon.
Right. Look what's happening in L.A. and New York. I mean, they just covered the things with concrete,
right,
you know, essentially.
Yeah.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, and sort of the theme of the show is that the question is the old way and the habit way or the new way, the novel way. And apparently it's happening to us individually. It's happening to the planet. It's happening to our institutions. It seems to be happening, really does seem to be this fractal representation of the thing happening in all places and in all imaginable ways.
I would argue there's no denying that, you know, whatsoever at this point. You know, I think it's just a matter of how one chooses, you know, what particular paradigm one chooses to overlay on the process.
Yeah.
You know, I think from my perspective, you know, that the paradigm that's in play, or, you know, the paradigm that seems to be one that resonates is in alignment with how we've seen the cosmos unfold and complexify over time up until now. You know, we're conscious beings as part of sentience as well, you know, and that consciousness has a role in coming to terms with the nature of this process and the imagery, you know, that we create and use, you know, to be meaningful metaphors and sort of signposts along the way to help guide us, you know, on a path. You know, I had a conversation with a woman, you know, at a gathering a couple of weeks ago in Santa Fe. And she says, I mean, you know, why do we need to know a path or a route, or, you know, it's like, why don't we just be? Well, you know, there's something to me about knowing how to get to my friend's house, knowing that path, you know. There's something meaningful about that. There's also something meaningful about me knowing something about the path, you know, a larger evolutionary path I might be on, or... this path is that's a process that involves all of us in the planet, and maybe, you know, you know, brothers and sisters scattered throughout the cosmos. There's meaning for me in that, the fact that I can learn how to navigate that path.
Yeah, and you bring two things to mind. First of all, the path, I think, is really important, as you mentioned, and for two reasons. First of all, because of the experience that happens along it,
yes,
along the path, but also, and this is one where I usually part ways with certain philosophical ideologies. The idea that, you know, it's not the destination but the trip, this sort of thing. I disagree with that. I think the path is important, but the destination is damn important too, because I don't want to be traveling forever. And I do think that there is a purpose and a place, an eschaton, and I really do think that the path is important, but the path really does have a destination, and the destination is a place that I think is going to be remarkable, and I'm dying to get there.
Yeah, for me, destination in that context is about, again, let's go back to pattern. The pattern or the shape or the form that life in our environment, our relationships take. You know, what is that pattern going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we shift into a new pattern. But I also think that we live in a, you know, this is, again, my personal perspective. I think we live in a cosmos that's perhaps even infinitely, you know, evolving. And there is no end point in the usual sense. But there are these phases that we shift into that are maintained for a period of time, you know. Mm. And it feels to me like we may be shifting, certainly personally and collectively when I look around me, into such a, this is a phase shift of some kind of tremendous significance.
Well, I feel the same way, John, and I think that as you and I always sort of end up like this at the end of our shows, we just sort of go, well, I'm in. Whatever's coming, I'm in.
You know, that's the question. You know, that's the answer to the question, you know, are you in or out in terms of participating in this, you know, no matter what comes. And when that was posed to me a while back, my answer was almost immediately, I'm in. You know, there's no question. I don't care what the challenges are.
Yeah.
You know, this is an extraordinary time to be alive, a nexus in space and time, the likes of which this planet may not have seen before.
Well, John, I'm in too, and it's a pleasure to be in with you next to me there, brother.
All right. It's my pleasure, man.
Well, it has been a great, fun evening and talk with Dr. John Sheliak. We're about at the end of our program here, so we'll mention one more time the website, johnsheliak.com. And, John, once again, thank you very much, my friend.
My pleasure. It's been a real joy to be here, Mike, and see you and talk with you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we're going to wrap things up here with one more from the Bean Growers. This is a song that's called, well, I wasn't going to play it, but I will. It's called Life's a Bitch, and Then She Sings in Your Band. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Stick around for Ruth and Crash Landing in just a minute.
Take your time.